Hey, we're live.
Hello. Booze Dancing is live across the airwaves. The Booze Dancing Network is taking over on a Whiskey Wednesday to chat with a special guest, friend of Angelo's. Should we just bring him right in?
Should we run a quick intro?
Run a quick intro, then we'll bring our special guest in.
All right, fine. All right, let me run the intro.
Welcome to What We Watch When We Drink, a Booze Dancing Entertainment Network podcast featuring lively discussions about movies, TV shows, and anything else that we're watching while we drink our favorite boozy beverages. If you enjoy this show, please subscribe on Apple, Spotify, Stitcher, Google, Audible, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. You can also find us on boozedancing.com, and if you have any questions, comments, show, or drink suggestions, email us at boozedancing@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you.
We are back on a Whiskey Wednesday live on YouTube, Facebook. Where else, Angela? We are on
LinkedIn, Twitter.
LinkedIn, Twitter. You can watch us in lots of places live. You can drop your comments in. How are we doing today on a Wednesday?
Doing good.
We're good? All right. Well, we have a special guest tonight. Rarely do we get folks from the industry to come in and accept. They all actually we do. We get always get in guests from the industry, and they always have last names that start with a Z.
That's true. We had Lisa Zambetti, and now we have Michael Zampino.
That's right. And next we're going to get who?
Wasn't there a Zanuck in the movie industry?
Daryl Zanuck will be here next week. That's right.
There you go. We can do that. We can do that.
Michael, welcome.
Well, thank you very much. Hello. Hello.
Hey, we got a substitute mic because the other mic can't make it. This works out pretty good.
Other mic's not here, right? So we have a better Michael.
I'm sorry I'm not Richard Zanuck, but who produced the movie we're going to talk about, but I'll stand in if you don't mind.
Oh, perfect, perfect.
It works. It works for me.
You guys know each other.
Yes.
How do you know each other?
I used to work at his dad's Colonial Village meat market in South Philly, which was down the street from my parents' house. And I worked there for what, 2-3 years when I was in high school and into college?
Yeah, some very important years. We were, I think, junior or senior year, something like that, in high school. And we hit it off pretty well. So much so that we're still doing this 30-plus years, almost 40.
Please don't remind me. Don't remind me that it's almost 40.
Keep that down. Keep that down. So you said 30 years. So you have been in Hollywood for about, in the entertainment world for about 30 years, right, Michael?
Yeah, I first came out here in 1993. I had a golden opportunity. I had been working in New York City with a small music video production company. We got an opportunity to produce a Lethal Weapon 3 music video. Of course, we didn't know it at the time, but we just were told, okay, be at this certain location and we'll fill you in when you get there and have all your equipment and bring take all the stops out. We're going to need Steadicam and everything. We got there and Dick Donner and Joel Silver were there. And we found out we were going to be recording with Sting, Eric Clapton, David Sanborn.
Oh my God.
Quite a thrill. And that led to an opportunity where Joel, I guess, liked what I did. And so he hired me to be an assistant for the head of production, which I was for almost a year. And that got me the taste of it, although it didn't last too long. It lasted about 9 months. I did a couple of films, Demolition Man being the main one, which I'm always pleasantly surprised that people remember and they always come up to me and mention about that film, which was an amazing opportunity. I mean, it seemed to have shot for weeks and weeks. I know we went over the 12 weeks think we had allotted, and it felt like it was more like ended in 16 weeks. But that's another movie to talk to you about someday. But I ended up coming back to New York and then eventually back full time in 2003. I've been out here ever since producing movies.
Can we say who you work for now?
Yeah, sure. I'm the VP of production for film and television for Miramax. Not the Miramax where those two guys that started it, but I have to remind people that they sold the company back in the 90s. So it's been 25 years since they were involved. So we've been making quite a number of films, a couple of which I'm very eager to come out in the next this coming November with Paul Giamatti called The Holdovers, which we're very excited about. Next year, we did a film with Robert Zemeckis, who's one of my favorites. His Back to the Future influenced me a great deal, which I told him. So I had to thrill to talk with him. He's as cordial and pleasant as I had hoped. And that's going to be basically bringing back the old Forrest Gump crew with Robin Wright and Tom Hanks.
But this is not a Forrest Gump movie.
It is not a Forrest Gump movie. It's okay. Just bringing, we have Alan Silvestri, the guy who did the score, who's amazing,
oh, yeah.
One of my favorite composers. That project should come out sometime next fall.
We had Lisa Zambetti on a few times. She's a casting director, and she got to tell us and our audience about what casting directors do. For the folks at home, talk about what an actual producer does. And you actually have line producer in your credits. What does a producer actually do?
There are many different types of producers. A producer could be, if you're true independent, it could be the uncle that gives you the money. Or it could be, in my profession at my company, it could be my CEO who will greenlight the films, and he nurses the films from script all the way to post-production. A line producer, which is what I've done most of my life, is the nuts and bolts producer that runs the day-to-day operations of a motion picture. So he or she's hired once a screenplay is written and is at least considered to be greenlit. And that's when I would do a script breakdown. I would schedule the film, figure out how long it's going to take to make, and then create a budget. And I would go back with that number to the producers or the studio, depending upon who's hiring me. And I would tell them my professional opinion of what the film's going to cost. If they feel it's within the money parameters that they want to spend, then I will be hired to run the day-to-day operations. So I will hire much of the below the line department heads, and they will hire their crew, and I will basically be keeping them on budget. So I will be constantly in discussion with them, seeing them on the set during prep, before that, all of which just to make sure that everything is going smoothly. If they have problems, they have to come to me and work them out. And typically it could be somebody in their crew is not working out and has to be replaced, or the fact that they just will come and throw their hands up and say, I can't do it for the money that I thought I could do it. And that sometimes happens. And you have to think pretty quick on your heels and either replace that person or, you know, sit down with them and help them to get what we need for the money we have.
Typically, are you on set?
These days, I'm more back at the office, and I hire an individual line producer. But in my days as a line producer, I would be on from almost first call or sometimes an hour before call because I would be superstitious. I'd want to make sure that everything was happening the way it should be happening. And I can sometimes be the last person to leave. I often start my day in my hotel room if I'm on location or at my home on the phone, dealing with the 9-to-5 business world before I ever get to a set. So if, for instance, a set's call time is at 4 p.m., I may be up at 11 a.m. dealing with accounting and paying bills, approving invoices, that kind of thing, before I even go into onto the set. And I will go through all the way into night. And if it's a night shoot, I may not finish until 7 a.m., get a few hours of sleep and back up again at 11.
Grueling.
I'm exhausted. I am exhausted.
That is grueling. When you get that producer credit, you know, it's not just a bunch of little letters on the screen. It, actually, there's some work involved with it, right?
It sure is, yeah.
La, 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 la.
So we are gathered tonight to talk about a film that you guys, I think, brought up.
The film is The Verdict. And, you know, when we were recruiting Michael for this one, I asked him what he wants to see. And this is the first one he came up with, which is great because I was actually curious to watch it again and potentially do a podcast. It is directed by Sidney Lumet, or Lumet, however you say it.
Sidney Lumet.
Oh, Lumet. Okay. The primary writer in the script, I believe, is David Mamet. And there were also two other writers listed on the IMDb, Barry Reed and J. Preston Allen. Stars Paul Newman, Charlotte Rampling, Jack Warden, James Mason, Milo O'Shea, Lindsay Krause, and a host of other actors.
Perfect. Does anyone have a drink here? We always like to say cheers before we start talking.
I've got a little sparkling beverage.
Awesome.
I brought a red wine that my wife tells me goes very well with a summer barbecue. She is a member of a Temecula winery called Ponte. We often get that and enjoy that during the summer. I can't say I'm much of a drinker, but I enjoy a good wine at dinner every once in a while.
Have you been down to that winery?
Oh, I have. It's a lot of fun. They have a fabulous selection, not to mention some wonderful food that goes. We've had dinner and brunch there on a Sunday. It's always an enjoyable experience down in Temecula.
I'm drinking a Game of Thrones, somewhere in the movie world here, TV world, the Game of Thrones Lagavulin 9 that came out back when during the second of the last season, I think. Diageo had this whole marketing thing with the production, and they have a distillery per family, per tribe in that they released. And this is a Lagavulin 9-year-old. Cheers.
We should be drinking Bushmill because that's Newman's drink in the movie.
It's true. I didn't think about that.
Now, the other Mike would say that's Protestant whiskey.
That's right. Really? Okay.
Yes.
Jameson is for Catholics, and Bushmills, I believe, is from Northern Ireland. It's from Belfast.
Let's dive into the movie. So where do you want to start?
Well, first of all, why did you pick this one, Michael?
I'm a really huge fan of both David Mamet and Sidney Lumet. Ever since I saw his 12 Angry Men, which was his first feature, I fell in love with the courtroom drama. You know, he's done so many fine films like Network and of course, I'm drawing a blank right now, but he came from television and he was an actor and he really was known to be an actor's director, someone that they loved to work with, someone who would do a lot of rehearsing. He would constantly work with the actor before they ever got to set to make sure they worked all the kinks out. And I think, especially if you look at the DVD commentary on this movie, he talks about that and how much it helped with a lot of the actors' performances. And it sure did, in my opinion. This is just a crisp film. I mean, I could go into it, the lighting, I could go into the art direction. There's so many things that I love, the camera movement, the old fashioned stills and dolly work that's in this movie. He doesn't waste close-ups like today, or it's not about quick cutting. There's a lot of scenes in this movie where he stays what feels like minutes on one shot, and he lets the performance come through. He doesn't always need to tell the story, as I say, in close-ups. He saves those for incredibly important moments that we can talk about when we go through the movie, but he doesn't waste anything. He's a very economical director who, when he would go location scouting, he would, as he says in the DVD commentary, he would let the location talk to him. If the location needed a lot of things to be brought in, it wasn't right for him. He almost liked a location to be ready just the way he found it, with very little art direction necessary. He said it was already there. And there are a lot of locations that he talks about in this movie where, you know, the library where Paul Newman and Jack Warden are researching. He just found that. He came and he found that, and he didn't have to do much work for that. So he says in the director's commentary about how sometimes movies will just come to him and he won't have to do much thinking. It'll all feel natural. And this is one of the films that he talks about. It just feels like an old fashioned movie that you don't see and you probably wouldn't see made today, especially if it didn't have an actor of Paul Newman's stature. As a film student, I remember it from the very beginning and watching it when I was very young. And it's, as you can see behind me, that's a still from the movie, as well as a few other stills and nerdy things that I have behind me. To me, it was the film that Newman best deserved the Oscar for. Now we know that, you know, he later gets it for The Color of Money, and he did some incredible work in The Hustler, and in Cool Hand Luke and so many other films. But I think this is the movie that he challenged himself. He took on the role of an alcoholic, of someone in utter despair, someone fighting depression, someone living in the past. And he made it his own and was well deserving of the nomination. He just ran into that year a buzzsaw of, that Gandhi took most of the awards that year.
I found a Roger Ebert review of it, and he had this great paragraph about Newman. He said, Frank Galvin provides Newman with the occasion for one of his great performances. This is the first movie in which Newman has looked a little old and a little tired. There are moments when his face sags and his eyes seem terribly weary, and we can look ahead clearly to the old man he will be playing in 10 years' time. Newman has always been an interesting actor, but sometimes his resiliency, his youthful vitality have obscured his performances. He has a tendency to always look great, and that's not always what the role calls for. This time, he gives us old, bone-tired, hungover, trembling, and heroic Frank Galvin, and we buy it lock, stock, and shot glass.
Touché, Roger.
Touché, yeah. It really nailed it. He's just an amazing presence on screen whenever he's on screen. And even when he's in the background of a shot, he's still a presence there, but never bigger than the moment. And maybe that has to do with the directing, or maybe it has to do with a great actor. I'm not sure.
Well, Aaron, I agree with you. There are scenes in the movie, one particular, I remember when Jack Warden's character, Mickey, is trying to cross-examine Dr. Thompson's character. You see Newman's character, Frank Galvin, in the background, almost cringing because he knows that this person will not help his case and that he's thinking inside, what am I going to do? What am I going to do? He's in a panic. You know, we talked about his alcoholism that, ironically, Robert Redford was going to initially play this role.
I saw and that, yeah.
He just said, I don't want to play an alcoholic. I didn't want to. And Sidney talks about the fact that Paul, when he read the script, he immediately took a liking to it and took to the challenge, where not to say Robert isn't a fine actor, but he just didn't feel the character like Newman did. And, you know, Newman started working, as I mentioned before, during rehearsals. But after 2 weeks rehearsals, he said he knew he had so much work left with this character. So, you know, there's a lot of things that he brought to the character. He's exhausting to look at. This is a man who spends most of his nights at a bar drinking pretty heavily. He has the shakes. There's a scene where he can't even pick up his shot glass. As an ambulance chaser, as this character who's so desperate, he will go in and spray Banaca.
I remember that.
It was funny to see.
Newman, that was his choice. You know, he said,
and the eye drops.
Something that,
and
yeah,
the eye drops, yeah,
and the eye, and the eye drops that he uses a lot. So he brought a lot to the character. As I said, it was an incredible performance of desperation. A lot of people at the time criticized the movie, saying, "Oh, this is against the Catholic Church," or "You're criticizing hospitals." And no, it wasn't any of those things. It was a story about a man's redemption, somebody that had a history, had fallen, was at his lowest point, and took a case that he felt could bring him back to the point that he had once was, the excellence that as a lawyer he once had.
You know, I watched it a couple times because I just put it on, you know, I have it on the background. It's such a quiet movie.
Yes, there's very little music.
Very little music. Yeah, yeah.
I watched it last week, yes. And I was like, where's the score?
That was purposely done. Sure. I think Johnny Mandel was the composer, if I'm not mistaken. You can correct me if I'm wrong.
We'll find that.
And he had done films with Sidney before, and they chose to let the film, in his words, breathe. There were just scenes that the natural background of the city worked better, and was only used in small bits just to make it that much more dramatic when it was used.
It wasn't just for, you know, to heighten the emotion of the scene. It was there for a purpose.
Well, today, and I think you'll agree, that you go into a theater and there are so many times that I watch a movie and I can't understand the dialogue. The music is so overwhelmingly loud and dramatic. And even in television, there are times I have to pause, rewind. What did they say? What? And this
You're
not
was a subtitle not, guy?
Yeah, you know, put the subtitles on. I can't understand what this person is saying because the music is so important. Not to say I don't love film scores. They're my favorite type of music, but in this case, it's a perfect example of a director that knew less is more.
I was just going to say that. And I kept thinking, as you said earlier, that the quiet moments, the non-dialogue moments are loud. They're so big. And yesterday was the one-year anniversary here of the death of Vin Scully. And Vin Scully was famous for not talking during the biggest moments of a baseball game. He would just be quiet.
He did it all. I mean, he never needed a color man. You know, he was a one-man show.
But he understood the moment around him was bigger than his voice. Quiet is important, too. Saying little is okay. Music's important when it's important.
I'd love to talk about some of the performances, especially James Mason, who was nominated for an Oscar. He was absolutely brilliant.
Always has been, and this is even more amazing.
Jack Warden is kind of like an unsung hero in this one.
Sidney talks about how wonderful, how real his characters always are.
When he's frustrated with Paul Newman in the beginning,
yes,
and he's telling Frank, look, I can't do this anymore.
Yeah.
You know, you're washed up, you're a mess, you know, you're never going to change. I just can't do it. And you just see the look on his face, you know, where he's just frustrated.
He's waking him up as he's coming out of a stupor. And this is his mentor. This is a father figure for him. And we believe Jack's character. We believe Mickey and everything that he's telling him, that he's just done. You know, it's an overused line, but I'm getting too old for this. I think it's used in this where he says that to Frank Galvin's the character. And it's true. He knows that this is his last shot. He's not going to do it anymore.
Going back to a Lethal Weapon that you were talking about, that's the Murtaugh line. I'm getting too old for this shit.
Exactly. It tends to be overused today, but you know, back then it was still rather fresh. Lamette talks about the fact that Charlotte Rampling actually reached out to him. She was living in Europe, in France, and flew herself over to audition. He had wanted to work with her. I think he had a little crush on her, and said that he had wanted to find something to work with her. And this turned out to be it. And she was just really understood the character, understood the motivations of the character, and really hit a home run with it.
I like Jack Warden. He's like the uncle that everybody has, right? He's always that gruff but lovable guy. And he's gruff and not so lovable in this. He's sort of the voice of reason. He's not what you normally would see from, at least as I recall, in other roles, that I think of Jack Warden. In some ways, he could have been Frank Galvin. He is just so good at being that fatherly figure to Frank, knows that Frank's got a problem, trying to help him get out of this weird world he's in, and he just wants to help his friend out. But he also understands at some point that Frank's trying to do the right thing, and I'm going to help him do the right thing.
You know, he got this character, as he puts it, as a moneymaker, a way for Frank to pay his bills, to make, you know, $70,000 to $100,000 or so to get out from under his debt and try and be a stepping stone to returning to a place where, you know, the stature he once had in the legal profession. But what does he do when Frank's character tells him, I'm going to try this case? He says, no, not this one. I know what I told you, but disregard what I told you. Don't do it here. Just take the money. You won. When they offer you money, they won.
You won. You took the words right out of my mouth. That was great.
And, and that's real. That's what we all would say. One of the things that I remember Sidney saying was that a lot of the locations they chose were purposely large, cavernous locations. The hospital scenes, a lot of the scenes where Frank's law offices are at, they're purposely humongous to display what he is up against. He is up against the Roman Catholic Church. He is up against this huge hospital, these two prominent doctors, not to mention the best defense lawyer in town, the character of Kincannon, who is ruthless, who we see does a lot of work. He does a lot of pro bono work, but this is a man that is one of the partners in one of the largest law firms in Boston. And he's cutthroat. he ends up getting to Frank's Dr. Kildare, as he called him. He puts the right pressure to win and does whatever it takes to win. So Frank has to overcome this humongous force. Every time he gets a positive thing, he gets to sleep with Laura, and he actually goes home, brings her home to his hotel, and he's happy. And the next morning, he gets slapped down again. He goes to see and take pictures of his actual comatose patient, and all his plans for taking money are evaporated because he knows that if he does take the money, he's lost. As he says, I'll never get back. This is my opportunity. But to his partner, Mickey, his mentor, Mickey, it couldn't come at a worse time for him to all of a sudden grow a conscience.
Right. Well, that scene when he's taking the photos in the hospital and he just pauses and he's just like, what the hell am I doing here?
Yeah. And that's a tremendous credit to David Mamet. The way he wrote that, you know, a lot of writers would stretch out a topic that he played in three scenes. And I'll show you very quickly. There's the scene the night when a Frank Galvin, who's drunk on the phone with the sister of the comatose patient, and he's circling a number that he could accept, 150,000, 200,000, 250 on a pad of paper. And he hangs up the phone, and the next morning he goes in to take these pictures. And as you said, he's stunned by the reality of this human being that is lying tied to a machine who will never wake up again. And her life is this for the rest of her life until she succumbs to and dies. And then the very next scene, if I'm remembering correctly, is at the archdiocese. And he's right. Telling the archbishop, I came to take your money, but I can't, because if I do, I'm lost. And that happens in three scenes. But in reality, in film time, it happens in a little more than 5 minutes, whereas a lot of writers would have stretched that a long, long time. And it was unnecessary. We got to where we needed to go so we can move on and tell the story. And that's, again, something that shows Mamet's genius.
It's a very efficient film. It's only two
hours.
Very
efficient. Very efficient.
You know, and what's neat, too, and I was thinking about it because I had it on a little while ago. In the beginning, the opening scene where he's playing pinball in the bar, and he's in silhouette. He's
yes.
completely dark.
Yeah.
And he's down and out. He's not winning against the machine. And then that's kind of like, as he goes through the movie, you know, he's got his highs and he's in the light. He's back in his lows. He's back in silhouette. It was pretty interesting the way they did it.
The pinball machine actually was something that Sidney Lumet used to do during his depressing times. Whenever he was depressed, he would play a pinball, and that's where he took it from. And he would start his day off by playing a game of pinball. And he would say, if I do a good job today, maybe I'm going to have a good day. And if he didn't, well, that was, you know, maybe a foreshadowing of what was yet to come. So in the movie, in the very first scene, you know, he's doing okay. He's drinking, he's sipping and nursing a beer. But that's the opening shot. Now, later, when things start to go well for him, what happens? The pinball machine pops. He gets the high score and hot dog. You know, he's feeling good about himself. And by the way, that bar, just a little fact that I know you guys would be interested in. This was not the first time that he shot that bar, which is, I don't remember the name of it, but it's on 10th Street and Avenue B in New York City. It's a classic bar. And I'm pretty sure The Godfather shot there.
Really?
I thought that. I think Godfather 2.
It could have been Godfather 2 or Godfather 1. I thought it was the first Godfather. I could be wrong. When he saw those locations, he knew, I don't have to spend an enormous amount of time bringing in items and props and set dressing to make it look. It's here. Everything I need is right here.
So I thought, Michael, you were going to say that you love him as a director because he's from Philadelphia. That's what I really think.
Well, you know, I get a lot of grief because I'm out here in LA now. But yes, I'm a 4 for 4, as Anthony Gargano would say on 97.5, The Fanatic, which I listen to every day, putting in a plug for them. You can take that out if you can't.
Nah, I'll put it in. I'll leave it in.
I wake up at 7 in the morning or sometimes earlier to the morning shows just so I can feel closer to what's going on in Philadelphia sports. And that is a great fact. You know, I think he was born in Philadelphia or raised in Philadelphia.
I think I saw born at least. Yeah.
Yeah.
And Jack Warden's from Newark. So, and he's a Jersey guy.
Right.
not so far away. Yeah.
So let's talk about James Mason.
Yes, let's do that. He's
a Hall of Fame kind of actor, right?
As Sidney says, you didn't need to do much. He showed up and he had the character. He got it from the start. And, you know, there was three actors that weren't necessarily the finest actors ever, but they were three in Lamette's point of view, three of the greatest film actors. And he was one of them. The others were Spencer Tracy and Henry Fonda.
Boom.
And he got to work with two of them. He worked with Henry in 12 Angry Men. And he got to work with James Mason over and over again, but essentially here. And he ended up, as we said prior, getting a nomination for Best Supporting Actor for this.
You know, he doesn't have this large figure. He's not a big man.
No.
With that large suit he wears, he seems even smaller. Yes. But he's got this looming presence, especially over the Archdiocese. He's got this law firm that he's the man, right? He's the guy. And everyone,
he's the Prince of Darkness.
Yeah, right?
He's totally the Prince of Darkness, but he's not
the effing Prince of Darkness. Yes,
he's that, okay. Not that big looming character, large person. The way he speaks, the way he moves, he is just big. He makes that character so much bigger than it is.
He acts with a lot of his eyes, yeah. His facial expressions. I love how he takes his fingers in many scenes and will be like, touch his lip and he'll whisper something to a fellow lawyer, and you could barely hear it. And I've rewound it over and over again, and I can't understand what the hell he's saying, but it came out of his lips, so it must be important. He's frighteningly dominant and in control. And the only weakness you ever see is end of the movie when he realizes that the this judge played by Milo O'Shea. He doesn't have him in his back pocket, because up to this point, he's basically in the bag for him. Yeah. And he's doing everything that he could possibly want a judge to be doing. And he starts to sweat, so to speak, because the judge is allowing Lindsay Krause's character to Caitlin Costello Price to testify. And he knows, even when his doctor, Tolan, grabs him, after the judge has said, oh, no, we're striking that all from the record. And Tolan's character grabs him and he almost pulls away because he's watching the jury for the reaction. And he knows we've lost because they believed her. That's the only time you see weakness in his character. He's so dominantly cocksure about everything. It's absolutely fabulous by James Mason. I really want to talk about Lindsay Krause. She had done other Paul Newman movies, and one I'm sure you remember, Angela, the hockey movie.
Oh, Slapshot.
Right.
One of the women that I think it was the ex-wife of one of the players that Newman's character sleeps with. That was Lindsay Krause. And Lindsay loved to do accents. As you could probably hear in this movie, she does a pretty thick Irish accent in this movie. And it's so incredible that there are very few, as I mentioned earlier, close-ups in this movie. But one of the first in the movie is when Newman flies down on Eastern. Remember Eastern Airlines?
Yep.
When he flies down, I remember that from Philadelphia. That's good.
Frank.
And they fly down and Frank flies down and he confronts her in the schoolyard at the school where she now teaches children. And we zoom in because she knows who he is. She sees the Eastern ticket in his lapel. Her face is just softens and like, oh no, they found me. Newman says, will you help me? And I think she finally comes, as we see, she comes to the realization that she has to do what's right. She's got to stop running, which she has been doing. And that scene when she basically breaks down after cross-examination by James Mason's character, Concannon. Here's a little factoid, something that Lamette had never seen before. The actors applauded. They stood up and applauded the performance by Lindsay Krause. That's how incredible it was. And he says, I've seen a lot of crews do that, but this was the very first time I saw actors. And they were all there. Paul Newman was there. Mason was there. And they all stood and applauded her. That's how powerful her performance was in that one scene when she breaks down and cries and says, you know, who are these men? I wanted to be a nurse. And you look at it, I still get weepy. like you guys, I watched the movie before we did this, and I still get overwhelmed emotionally at how powerful her performance is.
Although it's funny, because what I think about when she says that is, who wants to be a nurse? I mean, really? I mean, really? Maybe it was a little
certainly
more
not today, the way they're treated, but you can only imagine how they must have been treated back then. And this kind of talks about it. They talk about how doctors kind of shit on them.
They still do. When you hit that call bell, who shows up? The nurse, not the doctor.
Back to James Mason for a second.
Yeah.
I love the juxtaposition of him in his conference room with all these partners and juniors, and they're laying out this strategy. This is the big bucks because they've got a big client, the church, and this is how they're going to do it. Whereas Frank, in his little ramshackle little piece of crap office, and crap's everywhere, there's booze and there's cigarettes and it's a mess. It's just this little guy versus big guy thing. And it's, you know, apples and oranges. They shouldn't even be in the same movie or same world. And that's the essence of the David and Goliath, right?
Right. What we were saying earlier, the grandeur that he's going up against, he has to overcome all these things, which, you know, he has to battle. And he's still battling through bouts of depression through the movie. Every time he has an up, he's kicked down again. Something happens. He goes to Laura for comfort. And she says, she's like a mother. She's like, I can't invest in failure anymore. I can't do that anymore, which tells us a lot about where she's coming from. You know, we later learn that, you know, she's divorced and, you know, she must have had a horrible marriage because she left her husband and is trying to get back into law and does something that, you know, she's obviously guilt stricken throughout the end of the movie and is trying to talk to Frank, but never seems to have the time to pour out her heart and say, I'm sorry, I did this. Can you forgive me? And as we find out, he finds out through Mickey finding the check in her bag. And that wonderful scene that I have to mention, where after we just see him begging Caitlin Costello Price to testify, we go right into a long shot on a New York City street where
Oh, that's great.
Character yeah. gets out of a cab. And Mickey is in front of the hotel and he says, what are you lost? And he says, I got to talk to you, Frank. Come on, let's go grab a bite around the corner. And we don't hear anything from the next 45 seconds, but no. street noise. And we know what he's saying to Frank, but we don't hear it. We just hear street sounds. And that's pure genius. And
it is.
It's absolutely fabulous because
no music, just street.
No music, no tension, but the sounds of the city. It's just absolutely brilliant. And of course, from there, we go right into the hotel bar where he's supposed to meet Laura, and he just punches her in the face.
Boxer.
Which today,
very well, today would be probably wouldn't happen.
Would be a problem. I'm not sure that scene would have remained.
And a little bit controversial then. The studio didn't want to have it end, right? I think.
That could very well be the case.
Yeah, I think I read that.
I hadn't heard that, but it doesn't mean it's not true.
Sidney Lumet wanted it in and forced their hand, and it needed to be there.
Controversial today, controversial maybe a little less so. Then there are a few times in the movie where, you know, he confronts her in a way where you almost feel the chauvinism of Frank Galvin, where, you know, like, what makes you so tough?
Yes. This is about the sparseness of the movie. We get little snippets of what his background is. We don't know anything. We just know this guy has been down on his luck. He's had, what, at least four cases in the last...
Four cases in 3 years.
That was it. And he didn't win any of them. We don't know much more than that. Paul Newman's visual we see on screen is that's who we know. And he tells a story by being physically by what we see, right? We don't even need to know that. Yeah. But I am curious what the background of Frank Galvin is.
If you know a lot of David Mamet's writings on stage and for film, he doesn't really show that side of himself. But in this movie, he really talks about his religion, his faith, especially in the monologues that Frank delivers at the end of the movie. And we almost can deal with the subtext of Galvin's character. We almost can say, you know, think to ourselves, well, here's a guy, he's an Irish Catholic, despite drinking Bushmill. He's probably an altar boy. The whole setting of the city of Boston was intentional. He had to think of one of the most Catholic cities in America. And a lot of that subtext is played in Frank's dialogue, as well as, you correctly pointing out, Frank bringing a lot of that stuff out through his actions.
Newman is just so good at this. This character was almost made for him.
It was definitely something that doesn't come around very long, and I think he recognized that from the minute he read the script.
And it was a good transition role for him, too, into like older, more mature characters.
He was definitely toward the twilight of his career. Some would say this role was the pinnacle of it. I couldn't argue much about it because I believe it was the film that he deserved the Oscar most for.
Absolutely.
Well, I'm pro Slapshot, so. So wave your magic producer wand here, and we're making this movie again in 2024. You said somebody earlier that you're going to be working with, and I think you could do it.
Tom Hanks.
Yeah.
I don't think there's anything that Tom can't do. You know, he's one of those actors. I used to think Tom Cruise, as he got older, would kind of morph into a Paul Newman-like actor. He still is a handsome man. You know, he's got his pros. Some people don't like him because of his religion. He still knows how to deliver a blockbuster. And from all that I've been told about working with him, he takes care of his crew. I don't think he's got a lot of friends in the stunt department.
Wonder why.
I've heard negative, I've heard positive, but you know, if he were to mature, maybe. I think Tom's got to be a little around my age. I'm 56. I think he's got to be around that age. In the next 5 years, I think he could probably play that type of role.
Yeah. It's funny you said that. I just did the math in my head here.
Paul Newman's around our age in this movie, 57.
How many of those actors were in their 50s? You look at Jack Warden. Thank you. He's probably in his late 50s at that time.
Would you have guessed?
They beat their bodies up. We couldn't believe 30 years later, that guy's still alive? Oh my God.
That's amazing. Oh,
who's the one guy? I was thinking of the firm when you mentioned Tom Cruise. The guy did the Quaker Oats commercials.
Ben King. I know who you mean, because that's the ultimate character who was in his early 50s and he looked like he was 75.
Right.
The guy from Cocoon.
Yeah, I can't think of his name.
Wilford Brimley. Wilford Brimley. Classic supporting actor, but prematurely old-looking gentleman.
What's funny about Newman is somewhere just after this is when he gets into auto racing. So he's in his late 50s, and then he gets into auto racing, and he's racing. He's an athlete. He becomes an athlete.
I think
he actually
started earlier than that.
He probably started earlier, but he gets serious, where he's really, you know, competing.
Yeah, he did Le Mans, he did Daytona, he's done all endurance races.
And that's not a young man's, you know, you're not doing that one, right?
No, but, you know, Cruise picked up a lot doing The Color of Money. He learned a lot of things from Newman, and a lot of his attitude about jumping out of planes. I think he would put his life on the line to do things that he felt drove him, no pun intended.
We don't see it so much anymore, is cigarette use in movie and TV.
Paul Newman did not smoke, but he smoked because Frank Galvin smoked. And that's not easy to pull off.
He looked like he'd been smoking forever.
How many times do you see actors today with a cigarette and you know that they don't smoke?
Right.
They hold it too elaborately, it's just so artificial. You go, that guy doesn't smoke or that woman doesn't smoke. He made it believable.
Even the drinking is very.
I think he would have admitted that he did drink.
He knew that. He knew how to do that.
The famous Newman joke about 24 beer cans in a case of beer, 24 hours in a day. Coincidence? I think
so. That's great.
I mean, that was Paul. I mean, he liked his beer. You know, he never let it stand between a great performance.
Hey, Ange, were you trying to look at any of the labels on the? On the shelf in that bar?
I was. I couldn't really read them, though.
I think there was just old Glenfiddich and... But they were real labels.
That was a pretty much no-nonsense bar, though. I just like when he said, just give me a beer. Didn't ask for anything particular, just give me a beer.
Well, we imagine that he's been in there so many years and so many times that he knows exactly what
he has a tab.
It would have been unnatural and unrealistic for a guy that supposedly his second home was that bar for him to go, let me have a Pabst Blue Ribbon or let me have something. We would have known what he would order.
I like the hangover cure that's sitting there in the morning.
Oh, with the eggs?
The eggs?
Yeah. It's waiting for the guy that's been there all night.
Crack an egg and just drink it.
Is that a thing in bars where they just have...
I'm sure it was.
Was?
I'm sure it was.
That
no,
is
I don't
so
know.
Funny. That no can't idea. Be just made up for the movie.
No, I'm sure it's something. You know, or like you grab a pickled egg from behind the bar. I don't know.
You know that scene you guys were talking about at the pinball machine in the beginning?
Yeah.
Yeah.
The first thing I thought of was Godfather 2 and Pacino, like with the in front of the window in Nevada at Lake Tahoe and the lake behind him. And it's just, he's a silhouette in the brightness behind him or in his dullness behind him. But he's just this looming character in that light. It's shadows and it's darkness and it's light. It's just beautiful.
Well, of course that was a conscious decision between the DP and the director, who evidently was in love with a Italian painter that I am not going to remember. So I'm not going to try.
Was it a Caravaggio?
Let's say it was.
Thank you, Angelo. Yes, it was.
Was it?
That's why my friend.
The only
was
one
so,
I know.
Oh my God!
That's it the was. Only one I know. It was, and one of the traits that he was known for was painting a lot of silhouette in shadow.
Chiaroscuro, dark and light.
Ooh,
this guy's
see,
good.
I know something.
You want
I know something. Look at that.
He knows what he's doing. He knows what he's doing. That's absolutely right, and that's exactly what they, you know, the DP sat down and said, look, you know, this is the motivation here. And so very little times do you see fill light being used. It was oftentimes him coming out of shadows. There's a scene where Laura is comforting Frank, who's lying in bed. The foreground is in complete darkness. The only light is coming from another room that's lit, maybe the kitchen, as she comes into his bedroom. And it's all purposely done that way. And it was all conscious based on this one Italian artist's work. And it really worked well. You know, all the color schemes that were chosen were all autumnal. Reds, golds, greens, browns. The only scene in the whole movie where you see blue was because it was unavoidable. It's a scene where Newman's walking up the street. There happened to be a beautiful day that day, and the water of Boston, I don't know the river in Boston, but whatever the river is behind him, and it's bright blue, and the sky is bright blue. It's the only time there's blue, any type of spring color in the whole movie.
The colors does it a lot. It creates that feeling throughout the movie, which makes it feel like a 1930s or 1940s film too, right? You know, this film could have been in black and white easily.
Yeah, it absolutely could have been.
And it would have been just as amazing.
Yeah,
because there's a starkness to it. There's a drabness to it. There's a darkness to it.
Oh, look at his apartment, where, you know, just how dingy it is and old, that old sink.
Yeah, it's a basement apartment. There are bars on the windows.
Yes. Hey, Ange, do you have numbers on the movie? Did it do well?
Numbers? Money-wise, I think it did okay. Pretty sizable budget for 1982 for this kind of movie. And I assume most of it was Paul Newman's salary. So the budget, it says $16 million. It came out December 17th, 1982. Gross U.S. box office in Canada, around $54 million. Mike, is that a good number?
That would have been a flop.
It would have cost $60 million too, though.
Of course, you're right. And we, you know, if you want to use inflation numbers, you'd hope that the profits probably would have tripled along with the budget. But today, the budget would have more than tripled. As a studio executive, I can tell you all the reasons why films cost what they cost, but that's for another show. I want to say one final thing. Unless you guys, if you guys have more, please. I love, as you can tell, I love the movie. But
I know you think.
What I know.
No, it's good. I like the passion.
How could you tell?
I love the passion.
One of the things was my favorite about this movie, and I always have to stop it and play it back, is the very end of the movie when you hear the telephone ringing.
Oh, yeah, that's awesome.
And it rings 14 times. I used to think it was 13, but I went back and listened to it. It's exactly 14 times it rings before it goes and fades to black. That and the scene, the shot exactly before that with Laura's character drunk, She drops her glass. She's lying in bed with a compress on her forehead. That was not in the original script. That was Lumet adding that. The ending of the movie was Newman looking across the way at the legal offices in the building there when he's congratulated by everybody after winning the case. He looks across. He sees Laura. He walks with Mickey. He looks back, and she's gone. And then we see them exiting. And that's the end of the movie as written. Lumet felt, and he spoke with the two characters involved. And they both agreed that it needed something. And thankfully, Mamet agreed. And it's just one of my favorite endings of a movie, how it just the ringing of the phone, no talking. He's drinking coffee, by the way. She's now the alcoholic. She's drinking. And he's sipping a cup of coffee. So that was their way of kind of saying this man has turned his life around. Love that. Cut to black.
We never find out what the final verdict, not the final verdict, but the final award is, do we?
Number. The amount, right, right.
They just say, can we do more?
I think you can assume it's a lot.
Well, early on, if you recall, his bravado of telling them, well, I think you're going to get 5 or 6 times as much. And sure enough, that's probably what they end up getting.
Right.
So instead of 210, which was the offer that he turned down, they probably got over $1 million.
Well, his original, like 70 or 80,000. This was around the same year as Trading Places, right?
Yeah.
Roughly?
Yeah.
So Trading Places, when they give Eddie Murphy the job, they tell him they're going to pay him $85,000. In today's dollars, that's $250,000.
Yeah.
So 70 grand back then was a sizable chunk of change.
That was the moneymaker that Mickey tells him. This is going to get you out of your hole. This is going to fix your life. I got you this for the, and you can't even, you don't even remember that you're about to meet your clients. I've given you one letter in 18 months. So, you know, he's pretty frustrated by it, but he gets his redemption. And that's what the movie's all about. This one man getting his redemption for all the pain and loss that he's had to go through.
There's this one little tidbit I saw on, I think it was on Wikipedia, that Bruce Willis is actually an uncredited.
Yes,
I saw that.
I'm glad. But I actually didn't read that. I noticed it and I went, that's
Bruce funny.
Willis. It's like, that's Bruce Willis right there.
So funny.
Yeah.
It's great.
Yeah,
who knew?
That's
and he'd be in a movie with Paul Newman.
That's the kind of fun trivia you love to see.
I love that stuff. I love that stuff.
Yeah.
God, it's just a great movie. And I'm glad you guys brought it up. And I'm not good with sitting with long movies. I fall asleep. So I watched it over 2 nights and I really absorbed it a lot. And I'm going to get my daughter, who's kind of a film buff nerd, to watch it. And I think she'll enjoy the whole lighting of it all. That's her.
I'm sure she will.
It's just a spectacular movie. There's a line here we're coming up to where movies just change dramatically. Filmmaking changes, and it's, you know, there's more action adventure. There's more Stallone and those kinds of movies are really taking off in the 80s, later in the 80s. And this is sort of that, the end of that.
Well, this has a lot more. It's naturalistic. It's gritty. You know,
yes.
It's not afraid to show you like just the dirt and the grime, whether it's the city or whether it's Frank's office or Frank's apartment. It's just kind of dingy. Yeah, you can tell he's a down on the luck kind of guy.
I think it's noirish. And
it didn't hurt that it had one of the greatest screenwriters of our era.
No,
one of
it did not.
Directors of our era. I mean, it was packed with some very, very talented men and
Absolutely.
Women.
Absolutely.
Yeah. We give it a thumbs up. I give it
2 thumbs up.
Thank you, Roger. Thank you.
Thumbs up. Though my 15-year-old was not a fan. He was bored.
Don't slap your son for that. He's entitled to his
No, it's okay.
But yeah. I will say I'm doubtful as you as a parent now. I'm completely, as a parent, I'm disappointed.
Well, what's interesting, though, is that, you know, my older son came in, and he's working in a movie theater, and he's working at the AMC around here. He comes in, he's like, what are you watching? So I tell him what he's watching. And he's like, because he really liked 12 Angry Men.
Oh, yeah.
So I think he would like this also. So I could probably get him to watch it.
I can't imagine he wouldn't. 12 Angry Men was such a tour de force. I mean, that's another film that I could spend hours talking about. I love, by the way, your Mildred Pierce podcast.
We loved the movie. It was
loved
fun.
It. I love that you talked about the television version, which was enjoyable, but came nothing, came, you know, didn't even touch, couldn't sniff the original.
No.
But there's so many classic movies that I enjoy you guys talking about. I really loved, ever since Angelo has introduced me to your show, guys, I got to say I'm a fan. Something I'll be following now for as long as you do them.
Well, we'll definitely pick another movie for us to do with you.
And we'll get Mike in too.
Well, this has been really enjoyable. I really enjoyed it. I love talking with you guys. As I said, I apologize if I've been gushing, but this is
we like it.
No, it's okay. Gush.
Gush away.
Yeah, no, this is a special movie for me, and thank you for talking about it with me.
Michael, this has been a pleasure. We've had you on probably longer than you wanted to. It's past.
No, I've enjoyed every minute. Thank you for giving me your value.
Don't go away. We're going to wrap this up, but hang on for a second. Yep.
Sure.
But this has been great. We've had Michael Zampino on, from Miramax, producer and a lover of a great film, The Verdict from 1982.
Just a little bit
of a fan. And we will have this out on a podcast at some point where you can just download it and listen when you want. And if you've been out there watching, thanks for watching. This is What We Watch When We Drink on the Booze Dancing Entertainment Network. And you want to take us out?
Yep, let's
Michael,
roll.
Thank you again.
Let's run the old. Where are the end
thank
credits?
You.
Where'd they go?
Where are those end credits?
Where are the end credits?
Where's your staff?
I am the staff, unfortunately, which is always your first mistake.
Well, you're overpaid.
Oh, here we go. End credits. All right, boys.
Boom. Let's go.
Ciao. Arrivederci.
Ciao.
Chiaro scuro.
If you enjoy this show, please subscribe on Apple, Spotify, Stitcher, Google, Audible, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. You can also find us on boozedancing.com. And if you have any questions, comments, show, or drink suggestions, email us at boozedancing@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you.